It was now 7 o'clock, and I would have liked nothing better than to go home and have my girlfriend, Debbie, cook me a nice, delicious dinner. But for the last several years, our financial circumstances have forced Debbie to work 3 nights a week as a waitress. After all, somebody had to bring in a little money. So I was on my own. But the worst thing of all was that I'd been trapped by an odd series of circumstances into agreeing to have dinner with a man I'd been avoiding literally for years.
What have you been up to today?
Oh, I've been doing a little bit of Michael and Us podcast editing. I've taken the dogs for a couple of walks. I have cleaned up one of the dogs' vomit. We're in a new stage of lockdown here in Toronto, though, so I'm feeling a little depressed about that. You know, it just feels like it's never going to end.
Yeah, you know, what's, I guess where this is our, we weren't planning on this, but we might as well do our kind of semi-regular Toronto COVID update segment. I mean, what's crazy about what's going on right now? I mean, the psychology of it, I mean, at least for me, is very interesting because on the one hand, like we just hit, I mean, it's technically our second highest number of new cases in a day, but it's actually really the highest because the previous record was, as I understand, like a combination, like they were catching up on a data delay or something. So I think it's like over 4,000 cases, if I have that right. So like the number of people who have been infected with COVID since like Christmas is vastly more than all the people that were infected with it between like the original lockdown and like the end of last year. And yet when the kind of first and to some extent, I guess the beginning of the second lockdown were happening, this is lockdown number 3, pretty much. When those lockdowns were happening, like, I mean, in the fall, like especially, there was like just no end to this in sight. But now this is like kind of mingling together, mixing together with the sense that like there is an end in sight. People are getting vaccinated, not quickly enough, but like there are lots of vaccines arriving. There is nominally a plan across Canada to have lots of people vaccinated. You know, a really sharp increase in vaccinations over the next, 4 to 6 weeks. And so at a time when actually people are less inclined than ever to be careful about their behavior, and are feeling like the end of this thing is actually a real possibility, we're now in the most dangerous, potentially dangerous phase. Well, no, the most dangerous phase of it in terms of the number of people being affected. So I don't know. There's no way to tie that up in a neat little bow, but that's kind of where things are at right now. And yeah, as Will said, we just went into another lockdown. So doesn't really change my behavior at all. But, you know, the main thing is that you can't go to patios, which for, I guess, a few weeks you could do with people in your bubble. So I partly saying this because I suspect the restrictions here in Toronto are actually a lot worse, are a lot more restrictive than they are where a lot of people are probably listening from.
Yeah. Do you get jealous of seeing like your American friends, people our age, posting pictures of just got my vaccination, basically the new equivalent of the voting selfie?
Yeah. I'm envious of that. I mean, I thought you were going to ask something slightly different, which was, you know, are you envious of your American or maybe British friends who are just like rollicking out in public? And I mean, I was going to say no, because like, I mean, I guess those countries are ahead of us in terms of their vaccination rates. But, you know, I feel like on the whole, they haven't been, I mean, not that we've been great and when it comes to our lockdowns, particularly in Ontario, but I feel like, you know, in the United States, especially, it's just been such a crazed patchwork. And it's, you know, I mean, it's difficult in this situation because on the one hand, it's like, you know, I'll be the first to admit that I find the restrictions like genuinely, especially at this point, I find them quite crippling.
Emotionally, yes.
Emotionally, psychologically, everything. I mean, it's like my days are, you know, I wake up, I basically work for, you know, between, I mean, on a good day, 6 or 7 hours, on a more busy day, 8, 9.
Morning to night, if we got a podcast to do.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's like kind of a 9 to 9 type situation. You know, I got a book I'm working on. Might have another book to start working on, and maybe a third one, you know, like that's kind of in an Inuit stage. I guess more on that down the road. But between those things and podcasting and just there being no opportunities to go outside. I mean, I go for runs and I take walks and stuff, but like you just can't really see anybody. So my girlfriend and I just, when we do have our down, you know, she's working a lot too. And when we do have our downtime, you know, we're just kind of watching TV and hanging out. There's not a lot else to do.
You know, you can meet people for a park hang, but there's kind of a lack of dynamism to a park hang. Like, it's fun in, you know, more normal circumstances when, like, you might go to someone's house and then, you know, you could make the decision, what if we went to a bar?
Yeah.
What if we invited someone else over? And those are the kind of things you can't do quite as easily anymore. It becomes, well, you got the park and it's the same dumb park you've been in fucking forever.
I have done,
there's nothing
I have
else
done,
to talk about.
I've done every park walk, every walk, every neighborhood walk. I've done like 10 or 15 times. Well, that's way too little, like way more time. I've done it like countless times over the course of the last like 12 or 13 months. Like I have to walk for like 4 hours to get far enough away from my apartment that I'm like encountering anything new. Like I have walked in like a 2-hour radius around my apartment. I have done every conceivable walk many times.
Sick of my stupid block. Okay, I live across the street from this kooky novelty house in Toronto. Anybody in the kind of Koreatown area knows that it's this home that they've put like all these like toys all over every square inch of the
house. I actually
house.
Don't know what you're talking about. And I'll just interject here to say that I'm quite interested in this. This is all new information to me, partly because
I've
never been to Will's house. He's been there for over a year, but your housewarming party was, I believe, about 5 days or something like that before lockdown started. I just got back from the United States and I was horribly sick, which people would have heard in my voice at the time. I had an awful cold and was really feeling out of it. So I didn't come. And so I've never seen your place. I have no idea what this novelty house you're talking about is.
I also just want to tell people that when we had the housewarming party, it was still mainstream to have a party at that time. Like it was within a matter
of
days.
This wasn't a super spreader event. It was before the lockdown, but I mean, people will remember from their own experiences, like none of us could have conceived of lockdown as it was at that point, like unless you lived in Italy where that was already happening and maybe in a handful of other places. Like we had no idea what was coming. And then even when the lockdown came, right, the assumption was like, well, this will last a few weeks, like, you know.
On like March 1st, we booked a trip to Europe. I don't know if I ever told you that, but we did. We were going to go to Paris and we were going to go to Switzerland.
Do you remember that slew of kind of that sort of like gray zone, like before the lockdowns, where there was like people posting these things where it's like, oh, you know, we booked this trip to Mexico. Like, should we still go? I feel like there were some of those even after the lockdowns. Like there was this kind of weird like interregnum where people were sort of like earnestly asking like whether they should sort of obey the travel advisories and stuff. And then, of course, those advisories like became restrictions, I suppose, more than advisories, and it became obvious.
Well, we realized after maybe about 2 months that the situation was like, well, okay, even if we're able to go to Paris in November, you're not going to be able to sit in a restaurant. There will only be like 3 people in each room at the Louvre at any given time. So it's like, well, okay, at that point.
Here's a funny lockdown thing from kind of my online world. So, you know, we've talked before about like my obsession with like YouTube bodybuilders, fitness influencers and stuff. I honestly spent a lot of time with those guys. I really like, there's some of them that I really like and I've learned a lot from them. And, you know, some of them are doing the lockdown thing and just like all the rest of us. But there's like a particular, I suppose, class of influencer, not just in fitness, but you see them in fitness, like the ones that have a lot of sponsorship, you know, often the ones that are very wealthy. They have had a completely different experience than the rest of us because a lot of them are in Dubai. There's so much. Dubai has just become this place where like I you know, should probably look into this before I speculate too much about it. But I think Dubai sort of like tourism board or whatever is probably like paying a lot of these people to be there and to like post constantly and stuff. Like they're not just doing sponsorship for like fitness brands and stuff. Like a lot of them are just kind of hanging out and the lives they have there are just like, you know, I mean, they're just, you know, swimming in pools, like, you know, sun-kissed beaches, and just they all look like they're having a great time. And
I thought things were terrible in Dubai. Was I misinformed?
Well, they're terrible if you're a migrant worker that's keeping the entire thing, you know, I mean, that is, it okay. is, it is like Metropolis, you know,
right, basically. Right.
but if you're someone with 500,000 Instagram followers and a popular YouTube account, you know, who posts about their macros every day, I think lockdown can be much better than it is in you know, most major cities.
Anyway, what I was going to say about the kooky novelty house across the street.
Yeah, sorry, like, I want to hear about that. Yeah.
As I said, I'll send you a picture of it when we're done. It's got toys all over the house, seashells, like little action figures just glued to every square inch of the front of the house. And the guy who has the house also has this van that, as I like the house, has just toys all over it, like super glued onto it. You know, you'll look at it and there'll be little Batmans, little Popeyes on top of his van, just smothered in it.
Is this your driveway you're describing?
No, I live across the street from Mr. Pee-wee Herman himself. Anyway, like, I'm quite used to this kooky novelty house now, and yet every time I go out, there's some, like, gawker there who's just, like, taking pictures of it and posing in front of it, and, you know, I'll go out in my pajamas to try to get the dog to take a shit or something, and, you know, it's like, oh, fuck, some other person taking a picture of this house, which is totally unfair of me, by the way, because, of course, if people are seeing the house for the very first time, they're going to be amused by it. But I've been living with this house for a year and a half, and it's one of the only things I've been able to see, and I'm tired of it.
Okay, so that is such a particular type of, like, local irritation you're describing. I have my own version of that, which is that when I used to live in Stratford, Ontario, which is, you know, for those who don't know, so Stratford, Ontario, I mean, it's actually a pretty remarkable place, and I suppose in some ways a remarkable achievement. You know, it's a former industrial town that used to make it used to make ball bearings. It used to have a major rail construction and repair yard. But some time ago, it became the center of one of the world's most famous and honestly one of the best Shakespeare festivals. And so, you know, it is kind of surreal. Like, I grew up 30-minute drive from Stratford. I ended up living there for a bit, first 2 years of high school there. And, you know, like, everything in Stratford is, like, all the high schools. It's, like, you know, Juliet Elementary. Like, just everything, you know, Falstaff. Like, everything is named, you know, like a river that I guess was, like, dug, that's just called the Avon, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, it would be kitschy if, like, the Shakespeare Festival wasn't so good. Which, I mean, it honestly is. And it's a very pretty little town. But,
Well, all the greats, like, you know, Christopher Plummer used to act there all the time. I believe Mr. William Shatner got his start there, did he not?
I think that's true. I once saw the, in the final run, his final run, I think he died a year later or something, one of the great Shakespearean actors of his generation, William Hutt, portray Prospero.
I saw that too, in fact, in The Tempest.
In The Tempest. I mean, one of the most breathtaking pieces of theater I've ever seen in my life. And then because it was Stratford, we saw Prospero getting out of his car, like, later when we were on our way home.
In fact, I saw William Hutt's Prospero, and then I think 2 or 3 years later they did it again with Plummer. So I saw it again then.
humble brag.
Well, what I remember, I'm very happy that I got that experience. What I remember about both of those is sometimes when you're such a great actor and also you get to a certain level of life, you just carry so much gravitas with you.
Yes.
That you don't even have to do anything when you're on stage, like Christopher Plummer can be on stage and he can just turn his head and it carries so much significance.
It's very real. Anyway, the thing before I started just praising Stratford, Ontario, which now I'm realizing in lockdown, especially how much I'd love to,
I wish I could go
to
visit.
Yeah. I mean, what I was going to say is when you actually live there, I mean, you know, the novelty wears off just like it does anywhere. But there are so many tourists in Stratford who are so just, like, in awe of these things that you're seeing every day.
Yeah.
And it does actually become very irritating. Like, and, you know, it attracts, like, there's a lot of like local and kind of, like, you know, like people that have driven a few hours or whatever, or who are, like, maybe, like, visiting Canada and then they just go to Stratford. But then there's also people that are, like, very wealthy international tourists who will fly in from, like, Australia, the United States, you know, Central Europe, places like that. And I don't know, they would always have, like, the most just annoying questions that they would put to, like, the locals who they obviously, like, you know, they some of them, it felt like they're kind of, like, looking down on you, and you're kind of like, buddy, you know, this is this is my town. I have to look at Falstaff High School every day. You know, this is my culture, not your costume. You know?
Yeah, and they think that you're like a paid like tourist advisor yeah. or something, you know.
but so not to like stay too long on this toy house, the Pee Wee Herman residence across the road from the Sloan Estates. But what's the point of this place? Like, is this just like a local eccentric, or is this like a business, or like?
No, it's a local eccentric. It's a guy who's decided to turn his house into a big toy house. I'll see him like working in his garage on some kooky contraption or another. I'm talking about him like I have contempt for him. I actually kind of like him. I like that there's this kooky toy house in the city, because these are the things that make a city a city.
Yeah, it's nice when, I mean, since every other building is either like an Indigo or a Starbucks at this point, it's nice when there's like just like some local color, as they used to say.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just saying that I'm tired of seeing people who are just so delighted by it every single day, all hours of the day.
No matter how many different ways you put it, it sounds like Ebenezer Scrooge. But I think I think people know what you. I think people
come
know
live
what
with me
mean.
For a year, and you'll feel it too. So I'll tell you some of the ways I've been passing time in lockdown. I have been reading some of the novels of Ed Wood.
Wow.
Somebody has re-released a bunch of them. I don't think they actually have the rights to them, but you can order them anyway. I read this book that he wrote in the early 70s called The Only House in Town. I've got a stack of his novels now, and I'm just going to kind of like go through them whenever the mood strikes me. And, you know, these are pornographic paperbacks, okay? That's how he made his living. But The Only House in Town was exciting for me because it is a...
Because it was so erotic, presumably.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Beginning to end, you know? But it was, I think, a novelization of a film that he made, a pornographic film that he made called Necromania. But it is hugely expanded from the film.
So it's Necromania deep lore.
Oh yeah, and this is what I always want from a novelization. Like you read most novelizations and they're just basically a transcript of the film. It's like, what the fuck's the point? I could just watch the movie. This, you learn all about Shirley and her husband, whose name escapes me right now, Bob, I think his name is. You learn all about their past lives, their histories, you know, their flirtations with other lifestyle choices. I'll tell you a few more things I like about the book. I like that clearly he sat down and wrote it without a plan in his head. He just had a page number that he eventually had to get to. So the book is relentlessly episodic, just one thing after another with no kind of arc, and then eventually it ends.
What are the pros like? Because I'm imagining like Kerouac writing The Subterraneans just like in a single long manuscript over 3 days while on uppers.
I mean, it's a bit like that. I'll just read the opening paragraph. They were the carpenters, and they were extremely unhappy. A state of mind which had existed for the entire 6 months they had been married. It was a strong unhappiness which threatened at every moment to pull them apart, explode the very world in which they had looked so longingly towards through the illusion of rose-colored glasses. I mean, it's impossible to read his prose without starting to sound like the amazing Criswell.
I was just thinking about Criswell as you were reading that. Yeah, I mean, it's better. That's better prose than fucking Dan Brown, and he wrote an international bestseller.
I mean, Ed Wood was a working writer. He wrote over 100 paperbacks and hundreds of short stories, so you got to hand it to him. I mean, the other thing that I found baffling about this book, which I mean, for the most part, this book is, I would not recommend this book for casual fans. It's actually like quite upsetting at times, some of the things that he writes about. Very gruesome and ugly stuff happens in this book. But I'm kind of baffled by just like, okay, it's interesting to just get like a portal into this man's brain, because he's like typing away, he's got a word count that he has to hit, and he has to hit it by a certain date. Anything is flowing out of him. And you find out some pretty horrifying things about him and what he thinks is erotic at that point. And it runs such a gamut, the things that he depicts in this book, without getting too graphic about it, that you're reading it thinking, what audience was this for? I mean, I don't think there's anybody whose inclinations line up to what's in this book except for him.
Well, I just like to interject and distance and disassociate myself from what Will just said. I don't take umbrage at very much, but there are a few things I can't stand, and the kink shaming of Edward D. Wood Jr. is one of them. So Will does not speak for the podcast as an institution here.
Don't get me wrong. He's a wonderful man and a beautiful man. And, you know, everything he writes in the book, I approve of, even when it's ugly and gruesome.
Well, speaking of novelizations and deep lore, it's a good moment to bring up a sort of a dumb idea that I really hope we can execute at some point that we've talked about, which is our plan to write a novelization of the movie Swing Vote. That gets into like the deep lore of like describes all the scenes in like lush detail, like really lays out the mise-en-scene, but then also like when you meet the different characters, you know, we're gonna have B stories, we're gonna have C stories, we're gonna have like character arcs. It's gonna be, you know, an epic on the scale of War and Peace is the hope.
I think that we should maybe talk about this a little bit because we may have some artistic differences here that I want to get ironed out. My feeling is we should not rewatch or read anything about Swing Vote before embarking on the novelization. I think we should just take whatever our memory of the movie is. And I remember that you've got Kevin Costner, who's that apathetic Homer Simpson-like non-voter. You've got his daughter, who's the very Lisa Simpson-ish character, telling him to vote. And then you've got Kelsey Grammer and Dennis Hopper, who are the Democrat and the Republican, respectively. Those are the four characters I remember. And I remember that, like, he's the tie-breaking vote. And it ends at a debate. So I would like to just like build the novel based on only that knowledge.
So it's a question of like, do we want this to be a postmodern endeavor or not? Like, do we want it just to be based in our own like memory of this thing that we saw 2 years ago? I mean, in a way, it's like, I feel like, you know, who has thought about Swing Vote as much as us? I'd wager none of the people involved in that movie have thought about it as much as us. So maybe we have every right to, like, take it, pick it up and run with it. I don't know.
I have a very exciting idea that, like, the opening chapter should just be, like, very beautiful and very descriptive of this Rust Belt town that Kevin Costner lives in. And it's like, you know, oh, the old Fitzsimmons house didn't look as good as it once did back in the 50s, back before the jobs all
went to Mexico. Yeah, gone was the plant that had sustained livelihoods and lives along with it, you know, something like that.
And, you know, eventually at the end of chapter one, we meet Kevin Costner and you know, we describe him. And then, you know, chapter two is all about Dennis Hopper. Chapter three is all about Kelsey Grammer. And by the way, those should be their names. They should be named Dennis Hopper, Kelsey Grammer, Kevin Costner.
So it's sort of what you're proposing is sort of postmodern hyper meta translation of the movie.
Yeah.
I'm into it. You want to know the most embarrassing like novelization I ever read of something?
Please.
It was kind of a novelization of Star Wars The Phantom Menace, but it was actually even dumber than that, if you can believe it. It was a version of Star Wars The Phantom Menace that was told in the form of Anakin Skywalker's diary. So like a firsthand account from the perspective of the Jake Lloyd character. I mean, it's good work for those who can get it. I bet the writer who, ghost wrote that for Anakin Skywalker made a killing.
I'll show you one of the crown jewels of my collection, which is the novelization of Taxi Driver.
Holy shit.
By Richard Ellman, based on an original screenplay by Paul Schrader. And what's the novelty of this is it's actually written from the point of view of Travis Bickle. Just to flip to a random page, I'm on page 29. By April 14th, I had given her a birthday. April 14th, the anniversary of our eyes first meeting a week ago on 58th and Broadway. I still didn't know a thing about her, except that I was madly in love with this person. If she was who I thought she was, my woman I could respond to. I tried writing notes to leave for her. I am a working person, vitally concerned about the welfare of our country. I want to help, Mr. Palantine. Can we talk? I want to meet. I think you are a lovely, clean woman. Could we be friends? There was also a sort of poem I scribbled to myself, though I would never send her that. I bring you my lonely death with open arms to love you, like a flower that smells sweetest whenever you are bending over. Well, I never finished that one because it seemed she would not understand. All that week, my favorite song was Killing Me Softly with His Song, and also Lean On Me, though not with Bill Withers. I wondered what her favorite song was. Anyway, it goes on like that.
I mean, that's extraordinary. I actually didn't know that that existed, but I mean, that really, I mean, it really puts like a whole different spin on the story to change the perspective that way.
I mean, it's
so creepy.
It's fascinating because one of the things that's interesting about the movie is that it only kind of gives you sparing entry into Travis Bickle's point of view. Like sometimes you'll hear his diary entries, but oftentimes the things that he does, like taking Sybil Shepherd to the porno theater, it's a mystery what his motivations are.
Well, we're just flying fast and loose on this one, folks, because I don't know, Will and I mean, it's Friday, you know, we thought we'd do a nice just chill episode to accompany our West Wing thing crossover and our QAnon episode this week, just to give you folks a little extra content. And also just to hang out, because Will and I are in no position to hang out in person right now, even though we live about, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes walk apart. I had just an eclectic mix of things that I was thinking about. I mean, this is, you know, again, just to kind of continue what I was saying before about my experience of lockdown, you know, it's boring, I suppose, in the sense that everyone experiences, but it's a paradox in a way, because there's also just like so much going on. There's so much going through my head. Like in my job, I'm just like constantly diving into so many different kinds of things, like for the podcast as well. So I've been thinking about various things, and I don't know, we don't need to go through this whole list, but these are just like some things that were on my desk today, either because I was directly writing about them or because I'm planning to write about them. I mean, the first is that, you know, Prince Philip is dead, obviously.
What a shame.
So yeah. I'm on the hunt for places like the National Review to come out with pro-monarchy things, which is just like the latest thing that's tickling me, this like obsession like that's really surfaced since the Meghan, Harry, Oprah sit down on the part of like people that have literally made a fetish out of the American Constitution. People that belong to a party that calls itself the Republican Party are like making clear their deference to this just like atrophied institution that belongs to like the country that, you know, their own country, their own polity was directly founded on a rebellion against this institution, but they love hierarchy so much that they, you know, they're showing their true colors. You know, today, I guess the big piece of news today was the defeat of the union vote in Bessemer, Alabama. I have to say this didn't really surprise me based on kind of what I was hearing. You know, I haven't been reporting on it myself, but I have colleagues who have, and it just didn't seem over the past few weeks like there were kind of signs of a successful union drive that you can see, and they weren't really present. So, you know, it's like little things like that, you know, labor reporters notice, like, you know, the fact that in certain, you know, testimonials in news articles and stuff, you know, you'd have people quoted who were actually like, you know, involved directly in the organizing. So like, not as much kind of like the rank and file people that you'd want to be giving those quotes if the drive was doing better. I should say though that you know, the way this will be framed is like, you know, workers don't want to join a union. Amazon workers don't want to join a union. That's not really correct here. I mean, this type of big vote at the National Labor Relations Board, unless in advance the union or other forces at play are able to restrict anti-union activities on the part of the employer, these things just very rarely succeed.
So what are some of the anti-union activities that go on in a context like this?
Well, think about, I mean, everybody's aware at this point, I think, of how much Amazon surveils its workforce, right? So, I mean, you can imagine, I mean, they're just constantly bombarding workers who are often, you know, very precarious and badly paid with just, I mean, they're allowed to lie, right? They can say, you know, say pretty much whatever they want. And like who exerts more day-to-day influence, who's in a position to exert more influence over like workers in an Amazon warehouse, their employer or a union that's external to that environment. I mean, there's now the union's actually challenging some of the tactics, some of the things Amazon has done, you know, may have been illegal. And basically in a vote like this, the employer, you know, the management side will do absolutely everything they can, including, you know, like engaging in heavy-handed, like thuggish tactics to stop a vote like this from succeeding. So really the key question to be asked is, you know, if the union knew it was going to lose, why did they proceed with the vote? And there is kind of an emerging debate about that. You know, some are suggesting that the purpose of the vote you know, they knew it wasn't going to succeed, but Vote attracted so much attention that, you know, it's like a rallying cry for future votes. You know, others might say that, you know, the union kind of squandered an opportunity. I don't have an opinion there myself. But, you know, I think the optimistic conclusion to all this, if I have one, if I can offer one, is that this did generate a lot of press. It got a lot of sympathy. And also it exposed Amazon's anti-union tactics. It made them very public. In a way that I don't think they had been before. It kind of forced figures like Jay Carney to stick their necks out and actually just be caught lying in public. Hat tip to Ken Klippenstein and others who've been doing such great reporting on all that.
Yeah, and now like peeing in bottles is part of the Amazon brand.
That's right. That's right. So that wouldn't have happened if this drive hadn't occurred. You know, it reminds me of a larger scale example of this is the Prop 22 vote in California, which we talked about on an earlier episode. You know, there's been some polling in the wake of that that found that a lot of people that voted yes, it was a pretty overwhelming vote in favor of this, like, just tech company bid to, like, downgrade their workers and make them into, like non-workers, strip them of wages and benefits and the ability to form a union, stuff like that. A lot of people who voted yes thought that the companies, their campaign, which they spent $200 million, right, the most expensive ballot initiative in history. These are companies that are all app-based. So, like, they can beam their agitprop directly into people's pockets when they're ordering food or whatever. And a lot of people thought that they were voting for, like, better healthcare, better wages for their for the people, you know, who are working at DoorDash or Uber Eats or whatever. That's what people thought they were doing because that's what they were told by the tech companies. The union side of that, the labor side, was outspent like 10-1. You know, money talks. You know, money is speech. If the freedom of speech is such a such a fraught topic these days. I think it's undeniable that all of the means of conveying speech in kind of a large scale and in a public way these days, you know, they require money. Or if you have money, you certainly have greater means to broadcast your opinions, broadcast your side of things. And that is one of the things that makes, any kind of unionization effort or any kind of effort on the part of labor in the face of these tech companies so difficult to resist. I actually think the fact that they're tech companies, the fact that they kind of exist online and through apps and have so much kind of surveillance they do over their workers gives the management side in these things an advantage that I don't think they had before, even in the days of like professional strike breakers and things like that. Anyway, that's all I'll say on that for now. But an example of, I don't know, just like how eclectic the stuff that ends up on my desk these days is. Something else I've been thinking a lot about for the first time in a few years is the state of Scottish nationalism. And I was really gripped by this piece in the New Statesman by this Scottish journalist by the name of Rory Scawthorne. It's called War on Woke, The Meaning of the ALBA Party. I highly recommend it. It's actually quite wonderfully written. And I don't think you have to be, as it were, interested in Scottish nationalism, which it, I think, admittedly to most of our listeners and probably to my co-host as well, is, you know, not something in front of mind a lot of the time. This is interesting as just a case study in the way that I suppose culture war bleeds into everything these days. You know, something we've talked about before is the way that, I guess, like conflicts between individuals are now often expressed in sort of political terms or can express themselves in like sort of macro political and ideological terms. And, you know, it can sometimes be difficult to extricate the personal from the political in these cases because sometimes they're both at play. The background here is that Alex Salmond, who's the former First Minister of Scotland, former leader of the Scottish National Party, he's launching this new party, the ALBA Party. He was replaced by Nicola Sturgeon, the current First Minister of Scotland, who is much more of a kind of conventional, I guess, social democratic Scottish nationalist. The SNP under her leadership, I think you might describe as more metropolitan. It's advocating a version of nationalism that is you know more inclusive, I suppose. It's been, you know, the SNP has been very like, you know, pro LGBT. You know, it's embraced social liberalism, things like that. But so Alex Salmond had this sexual assault trial for which he was acquitted. He was acquitted in the criminal sense. Although, as the piece points out, he was allegedly described by his own defense lawyer as, quote, an objectionable bully and, quote, a sex pest. The lawyer later withdrew his comments and referred himself to the Scottish Legal Complaints Commission.
Do you know the nature of the allegation?
It's not detailed here. I'm actually not sure. Needless to say, it was a very serious very serious allegation. But so, you know, Alex Salmond has been, you know, when he's been asked about this, there was a parliamentary inquiry into it, and his kind of, you know, his defense there was, well, I was acquitted in a court, and so that's the end of that. But so he's now trying to re-enter Scottish politics with his new ALBA party, which, I mean, there's so much just interesting at play. I think this is why this kind of case, this story grabbed me. So the point of the ALBA party is to leverage Scotland's, I guess it's a mixed member proportional system. It's the kind of system where you go and you have two votes. I don't know if it's officially MMP, but you vote on a list system and you vote for a local candidate as well. So Alex Salmond's ALBA party is only going to stand on the list. So they're not going to run like local candidates. And the official strategy is to create a supermajority for a referendum and for Scottish nationhood in the Scottish Parliament. You know, so that's the kind of like official idea of what this is. But as Rory Scawthorne points out in his great piece, you know, and the clues in the title, War on Woke, the meaning of the ALBA party, there's actually a schism here that this is expressing, which it seems is actually much more, you know, the root of Salmond's project. So, you know, there's this backdrop of, you know, he himself feels he's been, you know, canceled or whatever. I mean, he's, you know, and he has this rivalry with Nicola Sturgeon, who is certainly to his left and who, you know, he kind of mentored, it seems. So it's this, you know, this personal political rivalry and this kind of beef with parts of his own former party that he was the leader of. But also, you know, he is expressing, according to this piece, a kind of alternative current in Scottish nationalism, which is very hostile to the kind of social liberalism of the Sturgeon era SNP. So, you know, Scottish nationalism, you know, this, you see this in a lot of, you see this in a lot of kind of nationalist coalitions, right? I mean, they are by their very nature coalitions. And, you know, sometimes what brings them together is often the idea of national sovereignty or the idea of national independence and you know, not much else, right? Or you know, insofar as there is consensus, there's often kind of big splits on other issues, you know, you know, Canadian listeners, you know, those familiar with Quebec will know this especially. Anyway, I you know, I'm not an expert on this at all. I was trying to think of a way that I could write about this or something. I probably won't, because I don't really think there, you know, I don't really think there's like a particularly like a left angle on this. But I'm very interested in nationalism, and I thought this story did a really good job of showing all the complexities at play in kind of nationalist projects, but then also the way that just the culture war and these particular kind of grievances and the sort of fusing together of the personal and political, how that just kind of seeps into everything these days.
Out of curiosity, is there any sense in that article of what kind of popular base this new party has?
The potential popular base, right, is anybody who is, you know, hostile to like the wokerati or whatever.
I see. Yeah.
So, you know, I think perhaps older SNP supporters, ones who do not live in places like Glasgow, ones that have, you know, a kind of visceral hostility to what they think of as a sort of metropolitan identity, that kind of thing. The kind of people that read anti-trans blogs, of which there seem to be a lot in, you know, the United Kingdom as a whole, like that kind of thing. I mean, in terms of the numbers, I mean, apparently at one point there was kind of a pitch that this was going to, you know, in the first poll, this was going to be polling at 30%. I think they scored 3% in the first poll. So at the moment, this does not command, you know, a great deal of popular support, although who knows, that could possibly change. I mean, obviously, new parties do really badly in a system like Canada, a system like the United States, right? Because it's very hard for them to break in because of, you know, what's broadly called strategic voting, right? People don't want to waste their vote, as the expression goes in Canada. As I've heard at the door a million times from people voting Liberal who say they want to vote for the NDP. But that's not really true in a place like Scotland, because when you vote on a list, I mean, you just, like, the votes are just kind of proportionally assigned. So, you know, Alex Salmond could end up with representation for this new party of some kind. I don't know how much, we don't know. For that reason, I'm going to be following this very closely because I'm interested in, you know, like what happens under a system of proportional representation if you launch a party based on a mix of like personal grievance and, you know, when you're like a partly disgraced former political figure and you launch a party based on kind of personal grievance and also like sort of like right inflected culture war stuff, like what happens? I guess we're about to find out.
I guess one of the reasons I asked what the popular base was because I'm curious to what extent he was a potent enough symbol for cancel culture gone awry. Like, I'm curious if there actually is a large base of people who think he somehow got a raw deal in the way that there inexplicably is for Al Franken in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, for what it's worth, I think the charges against Salmon were far more serious than the ones against Al Franken. But yeah, I mean, it's true.
But that Franken has become like a symbol of like the guy who got thrown to the wolves without due process.
That's right. And you know, you find these, some of the like Andrew Cuomo dead enders that you find, like they will always bring up Al Franken, like Kirsten Gillibrand, who is like such a, I mean, I don't know, it's like not a particularly interesting or a particularly progressive Democratic politician. Like in the same way that there's like these total like 2016 dead, like Hillary dead enders who are obsessed with Susan Sarandon. Like there's a constituency of like Al Franken and like, I guess, Andrew Cuomo dead enders as well, who like have created a folk demon out of Kirsten Gillibrand.
Yeah, I don't get it with Al Franken, you know, just a senator who used to be a comedian.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was one of the things about that case that, you know, so all of the sort of details of it aside and all of the substance of the allegations aside, what I could not understand is why people were so emotionally invested in the personality of Al Franken in particular. It's like, maybe, I mean, I'm sure we have listeners in Minnesota who could explain this to us. I'm saying this partly out of genuine ignorance of Al Franken. There may be something about what his political kind of brand and niche was that I'm not aware of, but it was just,
I think,
surprising.
He sort of branded himself as a progressive Democrat,
so to speak. He definitely did. And if you looked at his voting record, in the Senate, that's probably largely borne out, but I don't know, just from like what I've seen of Frank, and it's hard for me to imagine people kind of identifying with him so strongly as a political figure.
Well, you know, it was fun to have an SNL cast member in the Senate for a little while. I kind of think it comes down to that at some point.
Well, just so as a kind of throw forward to something that I think we're going to talk about next week and possibly have a pretty interesting guest for, I'm hoping. There's this, if not next week, soon. So this new documentary about the WeWork startup that I just watched. I think I'm going to write a review of it, and I'm hoping we can talk about it next week. And I don't want to say too much about it because, you know, we're hopefully going to do an episode on it. But, Will, are you aware of WeWork and kind of what it was? It's extraordinary.
No, I only know the name.
Okay, so it is like the Fire Festival of startups. It combines, like, imagine the Fire Festival and like Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos like fused into one thing. Okay, so basically the idea was that, like, you know, this company I mean all it is a co-working space. Okay, like they rent properties and then they and the properties are like, you know, given this sort of like very startup-y like they're like these chill spaces where, you know, people that describe their businesses as like incubating things like work, like that sort of place. You know, there's like lots of coffee and
probably,
you know,
a ping pong table.
Yeah,
in there somewhere.
100%. You know, yeah, they have like a barista with like a twirly mustache that works there, like, you know, that kind of thing. But the company was co-founded, you know, sort of public face of it. You know, there's two kind of co-founders, but the public face of it is this guy Adam Neumann, who is like, you know, I mean, he's referred to in the documentary repeatedly as, you know, this charismatic figure. And that's certainly how he was reported, you know, discussed in the kind of, you know, business press for years. And when you see him a ton in the movie, and he speaks like exclusively in these like meaningless motivational sound bites. And this company basically coasted its way to a $47 billion valuation just on the basis of like bullshit, like tech babble, like alone, like really, really nothing else. There's this like cultish company culture. They would like take people to these like staff retreats where they're just like, they'd be subjected to sort of like weird new agey seminars all day and sort of like messianic videos about the the founder, but then they would just get like super drunk and get to play games at night and stuff. So like and then they branched out into you know, we live, I think it was called, like literally, you know, so people were living in what were again packaged as this, you know, this is it's like Uber, but for living. And it's like, okay, so it's fucking grown ass adults living in these like 100-square-foot things that are basically dormitories. It's like, this is the future. And like the messianic language around this stuff was so kind of soaring that they're talking about like changing the world, like it's truly extraordinary. And of course the whole thing, spoiler, you know, came crashing down. The company lost tens of billions in valuation in the span of 6 weeks.
Oh, so the system works is what you're saying.
But so there's a lot to discuss in relation to this. The documentary is very entertaining, although I actually think it has some pretty big blind spots I'm going to discuss in a review that I'm writing.
What's the documentary called again?
It's called WeWork, or The Making and Breaking of a 47 Billion Unicorn. So it's, you know, it is really the perfect encapsulation. It's the perfect case study in just the depraved culture of Silicon Valley, and how like literally like renting space was spun, like the idea of renting space and a company that was basically operating as a kind of quasi real estate company, but was like refusing, it was rejecting the label of being a real estate company. How it basically just like took Silicon Valley hucksterdom like to like its furthest extreme. I mean, I don't know, Theranos is pretty is pretty Herculean competition. Like, if people are familiar with that case, you know, I mean, I guess that was partly the marketing around Holmes herself, who really convinced a lot of extremely dumb rich people that she was like the female Steve Jobs or whatever. She used to like, she even like
she dressed like him,
she wore these turtlenecks. I mean, there's speculation in the HBO documentary about her and about the Theranos case that like, and I mean, honestly, there's probably something to this, that like just a lot of these like older rich people were kind of like attracted to her. Like, you know, I mean, there's like George Shultz, like the former Secretary of State, became an investor in Theranos. But, you know, she essentially conned, you know, she spun this whole narrative about, you know, this inspiring entrepreneur and stuff like that. But in her case, like, it was premised on this way of like taking blood without a needle, and sort of like this kind of broader idea of like democratizing people's medical records or something like that, which never had any scientific foundation at all. Like, she apparently, when she was a student, I guess at Harvard or somewhere like that, she walked into a professor's office and pitched this idea, and they were just like, well, that's not possible. And, you know, in typical Silicon Valley fashion, you know, like these people build these identities, both outwardly to the world, but it, you know, also seems like within themselves, like to some extent, these people really believe their own bullshit. They build these identities as these Promethean creators, where it's like, if we just will hard enough, we can overcome the laws of nature. Like, we're going to live forever. We're going to make it possible to like take blood out of your body without having to like, you know, have a needle pass through your skin, whatever. Like, we're going to change the nature of labor and work, and also living and education. So it's all the spin around WeWork, by renting properties to people that have startups, you know. Anyway, I don't want to say too much more on that, because I think we're going to do a whole episode on it. But it's super fun, and I think wow, you'll enjoy the documentary too. I did actually have one other thing that I, you know, since we're just kind of, you know, since this is an eclectic episode and we're just kind of covering a lot of bases, I realized there's a book that I've been meaning to recommend to you for quite a long time that I wanted to share with both you and our listeners. Just before we say goodbye here, there's a couple passages I want to read. We've done those kind of essential paragraphs episodes mm-hmm. before. And there's, you know, more than a few essential paragraphs for me in this incredible 1999 book. By a writer named Russell Jacoby. It's called The End of Utopia, Politics and Culture in an Age of Apathy. It's a book that I've been thinking about a lot recently. It was absolutely kind of earth-shattering to me when I first read it, which is well over 10 years ago now, I think. But it's especially interesting. You know, it's 1999, right? It was written. So it's a book that is really, you know, we've talked endlessly, right? It's become a meme how much we talk about the end of history, mm-hmm. right? This is a book by a left-wing writer that is, you know, in 1999 is really thinking through, you know, what that means for politics and culture. Like, you know, what things really, what things are going to be like at the end of history, both for, you know, liberals, but also for the left. And so it's an especially interesting book to think about now, because, you know, we've seen this big resurgence of the socialist left and kind of the return of political alternatives to liberalism. And so the chapter, or the book, opens with this incredible chapter called "The End of the End of the End of Ideology." And Jacobi kind of goes through all these different periods where people have, in, you know, Fukuyama-esque fashion, predicted the end of ideology. So the book begins in September 1955. Several hundred writers and scholars, from Raymond Aron to Arthur Schlesinger Jr., assembled in Milan's National Museum of Science and Technology to discuss, quote, the future of freedom. Their outlook was roughly liberal and anti-communist, their mood upbeat. Stalin had died. The new first secretary of the Soviet Communist Party, Nikita Khrushchev, spoke of detente and peace. Western Europe and the United States were prospering. Perhaps Marxism had a future in the underdeveloped nations, but elsewhere its days seemed past. One participant observed that an atmosphere of a post-victory ball prevailed. There was, noted Edward Schills, a sometimes rampant, sometimes quiet conviction that communism had lost the battle of ideas with the West. In most Western societies, the ideological controversy is dying down, stated Aron in his opening address. History has, quote, refuted the exaggerated hopes placed in revolution. Aron admitted that tensions still arise over equality, employment, wages, and inflation, but, quote, the reasonable anxieties they evoke do not give rise to any fundamental conflict. Serious people now agree on the basic framework of the welfare state. Hang on. So this goes on for a bit, and Jacobi walks us through a number of other examples where this happens. Of course, points out that, you know, by the 60s or 70s, this sort of brief, this fleeting 1950s consensus among some elites that there'd been an end of ideology was absolutely impossible to sustain. But then eventually Jacobi arrives at kind of the 1990s, and this is where I think the book is incredibly powerful in its discussion of the 1989 moment and kind of what came after. And here he's talking about its effects on, first on socialism. I'm going to read that part, and then on liberalism, which is the part that's always really stuck with me. The point is, everywhere the left becomes practical, pragmatic, and liberal. We need to rethink and reconstruct the concepts of socialism, writes Douglas Keller, a leftist professor, in an essay titled "The Obsolescence of Marxism?" Perhaps socialism could be seen more as a normative ideal than as a historical force. Socialist thought, writes Norman Birnbaum in an overview of the plight of socialism, is quite defensive, with no grand new projects or hopes. European socialists are, quote, chastened, content with very small stakes, afraid to ask more of themselves and their electorates. The brute fact, summarizes Stanley Aronowitz, is that, quote, there is little to distinguish the U.S. left from yesterday's everyday social welfare liberalism. Most appalling, we live in a time when the left has run out of ideas. One of the left's savviest thinkers concedes that the outlook is grim. None of the political currents that set out to challenge capitalism in this century has morale or compass today, concludes Perry Anderson in a lengthy encounter with Francis Fukuyama. The socialist vision has, quote, fallen into radical doubt. And then Jacobi goes on to talk about the impact all this has on liberals. What is true of the socialists need hardly be proved for those closer to the center, liberals. The difference between these political categories have never been clear, but it can be safely assumed that if leftists have abandoned a belief in a different future, liberals commit themselves more than ever to the welfare state. As the philosopher Richard Rorty puts it, quote, we liberals have no plausible large-scale scenario for the future. We have no ideas analogous to those of our grandfathers for changing the world. We must junk the big proposals that mizzled us in the past. Quote, I hope that we can banalize the entire vocabulary of leftist political deliberation. We must drop the term capitalism and, quote, conclude that bourgeois democratic welfare states are the best we can hope for. And this finally is kind of the essential paragraph for me. In an era without a left, political philosophers like Michael J. Sandel use a new or refurbished vocabulary to revive liberalism. He tells us in his well-received new book that we need, quote, a political agenda informed by the civic strand of freedom. What does that mean? The answer must be not much or not clear. Goodwill and earnestness mark Sandel's book, but its language turns soapy with incessant calls for civic virtue and republican freedoms. A political agenda informed by civic concerns would invite disagreement about the meaning of virtue and the forms of self-government, he writes with mounting excitement. If this says little, Sandel clarifies that the agenda faces two specific challenges. One is to devise political institutions capable of governing the global economy. The other is to cultivate the civic identities necessary to sustain those institutions, to supply them with the moral authority they require. Or he writes that, quote, to revitalize the civic strand of freedom, Americans must, quote, find a way to ask what economic arrangements are hospitable to self-government and how the public life of pluralist society must cultivate in citizens the expansive self-understanding that civic engagement requires. Jacoby concludes on that. This is a liberalism that has lost its mooring. Sandel runs on about moral authority and civil allegiances. The terms sound edifying and almost religious, but their meaning is obscure. The nouns pile up in neat mounds across the page. Civic virtue, civic identity, moral authority, common identity. To be sure, Sandel on occasion specifies activities that exemplify new citizenship. The practices seem worthy, but not particularly fresh or original, nor do they require a new rhetoric. So Jacoby's kind of thesis here, which has always really stuck with me, I mean, since I first encountered it, and I think is especially worth thinking about in relation to the present moment, even though this is a book from 1999. He writes, the vitality of liberalism rests on its left flank, which operates as its goad and critic. As the left surrenders a vision, liberalism loses its bearings. It turns flaccid and uncertain. And I think that is something that is so kind of, that's so relevant to so many things we've discussed on the show. It's relevant to the political moment we're living in. It's been relevant to every political moment in one way or another since Jacoby wrote those words in 1999. I think it's also extremely relevant in the realm of culture, which is something that Jacoby gets into later in the book. Anyway, well, what I'm really getting at is that you should get this book and read it so we can have a roundtable discussion of it on the show, because it's definitely been lingering in the background with a lot of stuff that I've said, and I'd like to turn you on to it as well.
The End of Utopia. Okay, I'll get it, and I'll make sure you get a copy of Ed Wood's The Only House in Town so that we can have a discussion on some really startling things that happen in the penultimate chapter of that book.
I mean, I think you're joking, but I would be down, honestly. Ed Wood is an underexplored topic for us, and you know, you are one of the great scholars of his corpus, so we'll have to talk more about him someday.
Yes.
Anyway, you know, a very eclectic, you know, episode for all of you. A nice chill one, certainly for us, and I hope for all of you listening as well. I hope that lockdown, wherever you are, is over or is in the process of ending. I hope you're able to get a vaccine or have gotten one already. I hope you and all of us are able to get out and see each other once again. And I hope that in the near future, Will and I will be able to bring you these podcasts from the Gore Lieberman studios and not from a web portal broadcast over Zoom, as we've been doing for the past 12 months.
I hope I get my vaccine. I don't really care about any of that other stuff. I just want the shot. Don't care when our listeners get it, you know, as long as I get it first.
Stay safe and healthy, everyone. We'll see you soon.
I rode home through the city streets. There wasn't a street. There wasn't a building that wasn't connected to some memory in my mind. There, I was buying a suit with my father. There, I was having an ice cream soda after school. When I finally came in, Debbie was home from work, and I told her everything about my dinner with Andre.